Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline won't be with us for today's interview, but check back next week and she'll be joining us again. And for those of you who are familiar with our show, you know that Caroline's also my mother and she's 86. And that's why I don't have her do every single week, because it's a little much at that age. But I hope I'm hanging in there and able to do as much as she does at 86. Anyway, our guest today is Mia P. Manansala, and she is a writer and book coach from Chicago who loves books and baking. She uses humor and murder to explore aspects of the Filipino diaspora, queerness, and her millennial love for pop culture, which I guess means she's a millennial.
Yeah.
Mia is the winner of multiple awards, including the 2016 Mystery Writers of America Helen McCloy Scholarship. And she's also a 2017 Pitch Wars alum and 2018 to 2020 mentor. So I'm going to ask her about that today, too. Her debut novel is titled Arsenic and Adobo. It comes out May 4th, which is probably in the past by the time you're listening to this, with Berkeley or Penguin Random House. And this is the first in a series. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mia.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this is exciting. Your first book, and it's a series. So how did that come about?
This is the first book I'm getting published, but it's not the first book I wrote. So in my bio, you mentioned Pitch Wars, so that was through another novel. For those of you who are new to writing, the path is not always straightforward. Not every book is going to go where you want it to be, but with this one, I got very lucky. I am on my second agent, and this is my second book, and there's something about it that just people just really gravitated to, and so Berkeley bought the first three books in the series. The second book comes out February 2022. I'm going to work on edits on that soon, and I'm currently working on book three. So it's very exciting, a little bit overwhelming, and, you know, kind of cliche. We're recording this literally the day before my debut, and it's just, you know, sometimes you're not ready for your dreams to come true. Yeah.
Well, you might be more ready than you think. So tell me a little more about Pitch Wars. What is that exactly?
Sure. So Pitch Wars is, it's kind of like a contest, but it's mostly a mentorship program. So it's meant to pair an unagented writer, an unpublished writer, with someone in the industry, someone who, so a writer who is agented, maybe a publishing professional. We've had a couple of like assistant editors or assistant agents join in as mentors. And basically you apply the way you would when you're querying an agent, because we want to prepare people for the traditional publishing industry. So you have to have a finished manuscript. You have to have like a query letter and a synopsis ready. And you choose the mentors that you want to apply for. You can choose up to four. And, you know, every year it's a different set of mentors. Some are in it for the long haul. As you said, I've been doing it since 2018. But every year it's, you know, different mentors that represent different genres and age categories. So it does middle grade, YA, and adult. And it's a revision program. So your mentor, once they've chosen you, will read your manuscript, send you an edit letter, just like you would from an editor. And then you have, depending on the time period changes every year, but it's usually roughly 3 months to revise your manuscript. And then some mentors are different than others. Some are very hands-off, and others are extremely involved. So me and my co-mentor, who was my mentor in 2017, Kelly Garrett, we're very hands-on. We help you break apart your manuscript. We help you plot and make it really, really strong and tight, get rid of all those plot holes. And then we are also there to encourage you, because we realize this is really hard, you know, breaking apart – and revising your entire manuscript under such a tight time frame can be really stressful. So a lot of us are there as your cheerleaders and your accountability buddies. And near the and the reason it's called pitch wars, not revision wars, is because at the end there is something we call the agent showcase, where you have like a 1 or 2 sentence pitch of your novel, and then maybe the first page, and then agents can go and comment asking for your manuscript. So it's not, it doesn't replace querying, but it does move you a little bit further up the top, because it can get very competitive. Agents usually clear their slates to make sure they have time to read Pitch Wars manuscripts, so it can be very helpful.
So it's, I'm looking at their website, which is pitchwars.org, so that leads me to believe it's a nonprofit agency of some sort. And who is actually behind this?
So Brenda Drake, she's a YA author, and I believe she started it in 2012, so it's been almost a decade that we've been doing this. In the, like, when it first started, it was a little bit smaller, and she was kind of like the head of everything. But it's grown a lot over the years. So there's a whole committee, and the director changes every year now, just because it's so much planning and it's so much to have on your shoulders. So and this is all volunteer work. Nobody's getting paid for this. It's not like a nonprofit in the way you say where we get donations or anything like that. I mean, you can donate, but that just goes to like running the website, basically.
Right,
like,
right.
Like, just because, you know, because on the day that the agent showcase goes up, a lot of people are logging in at the same time, and so in the past we've had a lot of server crashes. So any money that we get through donations pretty much just solely goes to running the website and making sure it runs as smoothly as possible.
How many people participate in this each year?
I think last year there might have been, I want to say, I mean, of like mentees that were actually chosen, I want to say like 180 or something like that. Less than 200 for sure. Somewhere, it's usually between 150 and 180 based on like the mentors and the mentor teams. But like how many people apply? Like thousands.
Wow. So you must have been pretty excited to be accepted the first time.
Yeah, it can be like a really big deal. You know, I know for some people it does. It does set up in your head an expectation. You know, like you think just because you're accepted into Pitch Wars, this means you're definitely going to get an agent. You're definitely going to get a publishing deal. And what I personally like about Pitch Wars is that it prepares in publishing is about rejection, unfortunately. And this kind of helps. You know, if your mentor kind of prepares you for that, you know, mine is incredibly supportive, but she's also very realistic. She's like, I think you're super talented, but unfortunately, that's always not always enough. So know that what you're learning through, you know, from me and from this program just makes you a stronger writer. So at the end of the day, you will come out of this with a stronger manuscript, more tools in your toolkit to make you a better writer, a better reviser, more information about the publishing industry. But when it comes to publishing, there are zero promises. Mm. And so she was very careful to set that expectation, you know, early. But I know a lot of people who choose to ignore that, or maybe they weren't properly, you know, informed. And so they, you know, they expect there's huge disappointment for some of them, you know, like if you don't get a request during the agent showcase, or maybe you got a lot of requests and somehow it still leads to no agent or no book deal. It kind of, you know, it prepares you, but it's still a really emotional experience in many different ways.
So how is Arsenic and Adobo different from the book that you did for the Pitch Wars?
They are both what people would consider traditional mystery. You know, they were both amateur sleuths. My first book, Death Comes to Comic-Con, it featured a queer Filipino millennial woman. Gee, I wonder who that's based on. solving a murder mystery at a comic book convention. So it wasn't a cozy the way this is. You know, it's still, you know, it was still very much amateur sleuth. It followed a lot of the tropes, but, you know, there was some language. There were certain things that, you know, maybe wouldn't fly in the cozy world. And so I got an agent with that book. And I actually got editor interest, but it never got further than that because a lot of the feedback I got was, we really love this. This is very fun. It's very different. And that means we can't sell it. Like, they couldn't figure out where it fit in the market. Because, you know, particularly because of, like, the Comic-Con aspect, they weren't sure. You know, the plot line was very traditional mystery, which according to them skews older. I disagree. but the setting skewed younger, and then they were like, there was this weird mismatch in their head, and they're like, we don't know who we're marketing this towards.
Okay, I can kind of understand that. I can see, you know, I think that there are a lot of older mystery, you know, cozy mystery type readers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's plenty of younger ones too, but they might not get the Comic-Con. They might not, but they might. It might be cool to be exposed to something a little different too, you know, outside of, you know, a New England bed and breakfast.
You know? Right. Yeah, I still love that book. You know, I haven't given up on it, but I've had to set it aside until maybe, you know, the industry is ready, the readership is there.
Well, that's very interesting because a lot of our guests who many did not get their first book published, or sometimes their second, sometimes they're on their fifth or sixth, but by the time they feel like they've really learned their craft, and many of them don't want that first book to ever see the light of day. That they, you know, they feel that it wasn't their best work. But I'm guessing that you had been writing a while before you actually wrote that book. Is that true?
I've always wanted to be a writer, and it's the first book I've ever finished. You know,
there's
a lot of like started manuscripts, you know, where I got nowhere. I liked the idea, but it didn't have enough steam for me to ever finish. That first book is the first book I ever took to completion, so it's really special to me.
Right.
If I'm being completely honest, I wouldn't want that book to be published as it is now, knowing, like, considering how much my writing has grown and what I know now. I do agree that I wouldn't want it to be released the way it is. But I still think there's something there. There's something in the heart of that story that still speaks to me, and I think could be revised heavily and told in a way that would make me happy where I am now. Because that story I started in 2015, and I'm a very different person now in 2021. So I do agree with that. Like, if someone was just like, yes, we will publish this, but we'll only take it the way it is now, I'd be like, maybe not. You know, this is not what I want with my name on it. But the story itself, the general idea, yes, I think it still can work.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Mm. Arsenic and Adobo is also really interesting, or a little different in terms of mysteries, because it combines a mystery with recipes and lots of writing about food. What in your background brought this out?
Well, food is one of my favorite things. And there's an entire subgenre of cozies that we would call culinary cozies that do revolve around food. And it's mine and my mom's favorite subgenre. My mom is the one who introduced me to these books. And, you know, as much as we enjoy them, it was kind of hard. Like, I still haven't really been able to find books that represent me and my experience and my family life the way I see it. You know, there's a lot of family oriented ones. There's lots of, you know, restaurant oriented ones. But, I have yet to see, you know, Filipino American characters in most mainstream media. And I really wanted to take these things that I love. Like, I genuinely love the cozy mystery genre. I absolutely love food. And I thought I had a very particular point of view that I wanted to put on the page. And so, you know, it's not me like reinventing the genre, but it is me putting like a, I don't know, I want to say like a fresh spin, you know. So like, I'm a millennial, this character is a little bit younger, and I just wanted to portray the world that I live in but don't really get to see on the page very often.
And what exactly is adobo?
Adobo is when in the Philippines, at least, because I know there's like a Latin version, which is a little bit different. Like, theirs is more of a spice. In the Philippines, it's one of our national dishes, and it's more of a style of cooking than like one single dish. It's basically like a protein, usually sometimes you can eat it with a vegetable, that is cooked in soy sauce, vinegar, and garlic. I say that, but like, there are so many different versions. You know, it can, you know, from family to family, from island to island, because the Philippines is an archipelago. There's like 7,000 islands. So you will never get like a perfectly straight answer from someone, you know, because for me, like, the adobo is the adobo that my father cooked. You know, like, if someone asks me, it's like, what has to be in there? It's whatever he put in it. Whereas someone else, it's their grandmother's recipe or their aunt's recipe, you know, or something like that. So it's very much, it's fairly simple. You know, it's like salty, tangy. It can be a little bit sweet. Some people put coconut milk in it, but it's very like comforting, almost homey food.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Mia P. Manansala. I'm not saying that quite right. Manansala. Did I get it
Yes.
that time? Okay.
Yes, thank you.
And she is the author of Arsenic and Adobo. And of course, there's a play on arsenic and old lace in there, which is a play that I saw my mother was in when I was a child. Have you seen that play? Do you love that play?
Oh, maybe like a long time. Like, if you were to ask, like, if you were to quiz me on it, I'd be like, oh no, like deer in headlights. But, you know, I say that my mom got me into the cozy mystery genre, but like, I've been a mystery fan ever since I was a child, because like my protagonist, I grew up in a multi-generational household. So we lived in my maternal grandparents' house. So it was my grandparents, parents, brothers, cousins, you know, a large household. And so, you know, I was that like 6-year-old kid watching Murder, She Wrote and Matlock and Perry Mason and, you know, with my grandparents, because they really enjoyed those shows. And so, like, I know I've seen that movie with them, or like the stage, well, it's also a movie
I think it
with
is,
them.
yeah.
I'm pretty sure I saw the movie version with them. But like, I can't like pinpoint, but I do, you know, I did like the play of it. You know, I wanted to reference, like, there's nothing in my book that references the movie specifically, but I like that feel, you know.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your dogs, because I see they feature quite prevalently on your webpage, and they're so cute.
Yeah. And you heard them when we first started
Yes,
recording.
I did.
So I currently have three dogs. And they're all basically seniors now. So my first dog is with Gumiho. I adopted her back when I was living in South Korea as an English teacher, and I brought her back with me to the States. So she's like the little, if you ever go to my site, she's like a very little one that looks almost like a fox, because Gumiho, it means like the, it's a mythological creature in Korean mythology, which is like a fox, like a shape-shifting fox spirit. And there's something very like adorable and kind of not bad, but like kind of like naughty about her. So I'm like, I thought it fit very well. And then I have two more dogs that I adopted here in Chicago. Bailey Banks is named after my husband's two favorite female wrestlers. She's the black dog with lots of gray now. She's kind of a cranky old lady who likes to just laze around. You know, she lives to sleep, eat, and drink water, and that's pretty much it. And then the last one, the only boy, that's Max Power. And he is very, very sweet. Even though he's the biggest of the trio, he is definitely the two girls are definitely the ones who run the place. He kind of backs away and lets them do their thing. Very sweet, very loyal, very submissive.
And what kind of dog is he?
I believe, according to the paperwork, I believe he is a Beagle mix.
Mm.
Yeah,
so,
like,
I can see that.
They're all,
I can
yeah.
see that.
Yeah.
Very
so I think,
sweet.
yeah, it's a Beagle mix, a Basset Hound mix, and a Jack Russell Terrier mix, I believe. They've all adopted, so we're all kind of like, we think?
Yeah, right, right.
But we're not sure.
Right. So your protagonist in Arsenic and Adobo is a dog lover, too.
Mm-hmm.
How much else about her is you?
A lot of things, like, at the very heart of her are very similar, but on outwardly it's very different. So we both were kind of raised with that in the Filipino culture, it's like family first, community is very important. We both believe it, but for her, there's a tinge of resentment to that. Because she's quite young. My protagonist is only 25. And also she lives in a small town, so she feels a little bit stifled by that because she was born and raised in the U.S. like me, and she also where is that line between selfishness and independence, right? When can you live your life and make your own choices? And when is that kind of like hurting your family because you're not there to meet their expectations in some ways? There's a lot of that. She also kind of has like a big fish in small pond syndrome, which I can kind of agree. Like, so I was born and raised in Chicago, so like not a small town like her, but I grew up in a working class neighborhood, majority Latinx. Graduating high school was like a big deal. A lot of people didn't in my area. So, the idea of wondering what else is out there, what more can I do, how can I make my mark, dreaming big and wanting to accomplish things, but also kind of feeling tied to your family. Because like I said, I grew up in a really large household. I'm the oldest child, which means there was a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. So those very base things I instilled in her because I thought there's a good sense of conflict there. And also is perfect with the whole like cultural divide between her and the older members of her family. But everything else I did not want to make her like a self insert the way I kind of did in my first book. I wanted her to be her own person.
So when did you decide that you wanted to write mysteries?
I can give like a very specific year. So when I said my first book, 2015,
mm-hmm.
So even though I've always loved mystery, I didn't think I was going to write it. I always thought I would be more of a kid lit author or maybe fantasy because that's kind of like where my head was when I was younger. I have so many like worlds that I started and I just never went anywhere with. But I had never taken a creative writing class. So I was an English major in college, but that's more academic writing and studying, not creative writing. And in 2015, I had been back from Korea for about a year after being gone for almost 4 years. And I kind of, it's like I felt kind of stuck. I love the people in my life, but I was just like, I'm going to be 30 soon. I'm back at home. I'm doing the same job, hanging out, like nothing felt like it had changed despite me being gone so long. And so I remembered that I really loved writing and I was like, why don't I try for real, instead of just dabbling like I did before. So I Googled Chicago writing class and I found a 1-day mystery writing workshop. That was affordable for me. And I was like, oh, okay. I like mysteries. Let's see what it's about. And it was taught by an author named Lori Rader Day. And that class basically changed my life. I came up with the idea for my first novel during that class. And when she saw, what I had written during that class, she was like, is this your first time? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, I think you're a mystery writer. And she told me about these organizations that she was part of, like Mystery Writers of America and Sisters in Crime, and how they had local meetings that were free. And she was basically like, I want I want you to see this through. I think you should join these organizations. There's some great opportunities here. It's a great chance to network, and I really want you to finish this. And yeah, I did.
Wow. So were you able to write full time at that point, or were you working a day job and just writing on the side?
Oh, day job. Definitely day job. So as I said, you know, one of the reasons I felt like nothing had changed is like, so I went abroad, taught English as a foreign language, for English language learners for about 3.5, close to 4 years. And then I came home and the job I had was teaching English to foreign language. And, you know, and I was just kind of like, oh, so I just, you know, I really enjoyed my job. But at the same time, I was just like, oh, so like I just kind of picked up where I left off and just kept on going. And, you know, and I didn't know if this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I was pretty sure it wasn't, despite how much I liked it and how much I loved teaching. So that kind of led to that part of like unease. And also when I first started there were no full-time positions. So I was only part-time. So I was just like, is this it? I'm just going to part-time teach English and then hope, you know, fingers crossed, a full-time position opens up. So for my first book, I was working there, and most of the one that's going to be published, unfortunately that school got shut down at the beginning of the pandemic. So I work at the library now.
Oh, that is that fun? Working? I mean,
yeah, actually, it's really nice.
I mean, for book nerds growing up, working at the library is like the dream job, isn't it?
It really is. And it's also nice because I work in youth services. So like, as I said before, I always thought I'd be a kid lit writer. And even though I don't think I'm going to start anything soon, being around kids, being around like children's literature, having a say in what programming we have and how we can promote certain authors and loves of reading, I'm like, oh, this is so nice. I'm really enjoying it.
Okay, so back to Arsenic and Adobo. You've the first book's coming out May 4th. The second book's coming out in February. Do you have the third one already sort of plotted out?
Yes, for the most part. So I had already turned in a proposal for it to my editors. So like I already have what I hope will be the title, you know, the first three chapters, a full outline and a synopsis. So I have like the big picture part of it done. But right now I'm still working on like the drafting of it, actually kind of getting it down on paper.
Wow. So it sounds like you work pretty fast once you get going.
I'm not naturally a fast writer. But I mean, deadlines are deadlines. So the second book was so hard. Because like in the industry, we have something called second book syndrome, where with the first book, it takes as long as it takes, right? Because nobody's waiting for it necessarily. The first book I wrote took about 2.5 years. Arsenic and Adobo took about 1.5 years, close to 2. And then suddenly, because I'm on a publishing schedule and cozies tend to be turned out fairly quickly, like cozies and romance have a really quick turnaround. So my books are supposed to be released 9 months apart, which means I have less than 9 months to write the book and revise it and get it, you know, out there. So, yeah. So the second book, doing it under such a tight, you know, deadline, like almost half of how I usually, you know, how I took with the other books during a pandemic, during, you know, that that job insecurity. It was a really hard time, but I do love the idea for my second book so much. So I'm really looking forward to editing and making it stronger.
Great. Great. And what is the name of the series?
The Tita Rosie's Kitchen Mystery Series. So Tita means, it means aunt in Tagalog. And so even though my protagonist is Lila, her aunt is kind of like, not just her heart, but kind of the heart of the series. So Tita Rosie's Kitchen is the restaurant that is her family restaurant that she's trying to save. And even though It's not going to be the main focal point in every book. It will be there in every single one because it's such an important part of Lila's world and the community of Shady Palms, which is where my book takes place.
And she's got a few romantic interests already kind of hovering around, so I'm sure we're going to see more about that.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Mia, why don't you read a little bit from Arsenic and Adobo?
Sure. My name is Lila Makapagal, and my life has become a rom-com cliche. Not many romantic comedies feature an Asian American lead, or dead bodies, but more on that later. But all the trademarks are there. Girlfriend in probably named small town in the Midwest moves to the big city to make a name for herself and find love. Check. Girl achieves these things, only for the world to come crashing down when she walks in on her fiancé getting down and dirty with her next-door neighbors. Yes, plural. Double check. Girl then moves back home in disgrace and finds work reinvigorating her aunt's failing business. Well, now we're up to a hat trick of cliches. And to put the cherry on top, in the trope of all tropes, I even reconnected with my high school sweetheart after moving back to town and discovered the true meaning of Christmas. Okay, that last part is a joke, but I really did run into my high school sweetheart, Derek Winter, my first love. Too bad he'd age into a ridiculous jerk with a puffed up sense of importance and weird vendetta against my family. Pretty much tried to shut down my aunt's restaurant on a weekly basis. Odd behavior from the guy who'd wanted to marry me right after high school, but what can I say? I had exceptionally bad taste when I was younger. You're dumb when you're 15 and hopped up on hormones. Heck, I'm 25 and still make bad decisions based on those same dumb hormones. Hence my working at my Tita Rosie's restaurant rather than running my own cafe, which is what I've been going to school for before I found out that Sam was a cheating scumbag. That was right around the time my aunt sent me a distress signal, and here we are. So instead of grinding my own coffee beans or brewing the delightful loose leaf teas I'd sourced for my dream cafe in Chicago, I now spent every morning preparing mugs of Copico 3-in-1 in my hometown of Shady Palms, Illinois, over 2 hours outside the city. The morning clientele at my Tita's Rose restaurant always included a bevy of gossiping aunties, none as loud or nosy as the group of 50-something-year-old women I privately referred to as the calendar crew. Their names were April, May, and June. They weren't related, but all three of them were completely interchangeable down to their bad perms, love of floral patterns, and need to provide running commentary on my life. It was their due. After all, they were my godmothers, yes, plural, and were my late mother's best friends. They loved and cared about me in their own infuriating way. I brought over their morning plate of pan de sal, and they descended like a pack of locusts upon the dish of lightly sweetened Filipino bread, spreading the warm rolls with butter and dipping them in their coffee or drizzling them with condensed milk. And like locusts, once they were done devouring one thing, they moved as a pack onto their next victim, me. Lila, why is everything you wear always dark? You look like a bruja. And your hair always is in ponytail and hat, not sexy. Ay, Nicole, what is this? You get bigger every time I see you. This last statement, accompanied by a firm pinch of my arm fat, was from Ninang April, who always had to have the final say. April always was the cruelest month. I was used to these digs against my appearance. It was how older Asians showed affection. I could ignore my godmother's first two comments. While being told you looked like a witch would bother most people, I considered it a compliment. I love natural remedies, dark color palettes, and made bewitchingly delicious baked goods, so I'd learned to lean into the bruja image. Everyone needed a personal brand. As for the baseball cap, it's not like I wore it as a fashion accessory. I worked in food service, and my family were sticklers for hygiene. It was either a cap or a hairnet, which thanks but no thanks. My weight gain, however, was a sore topic. Bad enough that I'd been eating my feelings and couldn't fit into my old clothes anymore. I didn't need them and their fat-phobic comments rubbing it in. Then again, I hadn't been home in almost 3 years. The recovering Catholic in me recognized that these barbs were just the beginning of the penance they would make me pay. I waved my hand dismissively. I mean, on April, I'm just adjusting to being back home. You know everybody eats well when Tita Rosie is around. The calendar crew all nodded as they helped themselves to the coconut jam and kisang puti I'd added to the table. Why do you think we come here all the time? The decor? Ninang May asked, gesturing around at the scuffed tables, mismatched silverware, and appliances from the 80s. Nobody cooks better than your Tita Rosie. A loud ha was the response to Ninang May's comment. We all turned toward the source of this rudeness, and my stomach clenched as I locked eyes with the only man I hated as much as my ex-fiancé, Derek Winter. Derek sipped at a travel cup of coffee and tapped his foot in a cartoonish show of impatience. "Hey, can I get a table already?" My godmothers all clicked their tongues in unison and began whispering furiously in Tagalog as I approached him. "I thought I made it very clear you weren't welcome here." His eyes crinkled in amusement, something I used to find so attractive, but his charms were wasted on me now. "Now, Lila, is that any way to treat a customer?" the man behind him asked. My eyes snapped to the newcomer. I hadn't realized Derek was dining with the guest. He'd always eaten alone before. Supposedly, dining solo made it easier for him to focus on the food so he could write his reviews. I figured he just didn't have any friends. And even more surprising than the idea of someone willingly spending time with Derek was his companion. What was Derek doing with our landlord? "Mr. Long, what are you doing here?" "What, a man can't have brunch with his son?" He clapped Derek on the shoulder, who flinched. "I've owned this plaza for a while now, but I've never tried your aunt's cooking. You missed another payment. So after seeing some of Derek's reviews, I figured I'd come see what the problem was. See if I could offer any assistance." I narrowed my eyes at Derek. "The problem, huh? And since when were these two related? You'd think he would have told me his mom had remarried when we first saw each other again, but I guess this was just another of his little omissions." Derek met my glare with a smirk and gestured toward his favorite table near the window. Honestly, how was it even possible to have a favorite table at a restaurant you allegedly despised? "Of course, make yourselves comfortable," I smiled sweetly and added, "but no outside food or drinks allowed." Derek rolled his eyes and started toward the door, but Mr. Long intercepted him. "Here, son, why don't you finish your drink and I'll put the thermos in the car. I got to call your mom real quick, so go ahead and order for me. I don't know what any of this food is anyway." I waited till Derek gulped down his drink and handed over the travel cup before hurrying to the kitchen to talk to my aunt and grandmother. Those two coming here together, especially after our latest warning about being behind on rent again, could only mean one thing for us. Trouble. Yeah. So that was the first chapter.
And that's me, Manansala, reading from Arsenic and Adobo. And that should pique the listener's interest.
Hopefully.
Now, you have not just Filipino characters in the book. You cover quite a few ethnicities. Mm-hmm. What are some of the others? And how do you know so much about all these kinds of food?
Yeah, so Lila's best friend is Adina Awan, who is Pakistani Muslim, along with her older brother, Amir, who is one of Lila's love interests. There is also, because it's very centered around food and because it's not a spoiler, it's literally on the back of the book, you know, it involves, you know, the death of a food critic in the restaurant. Part of her investigation is checking out other restaurants in the area who were affected by this same food critic. So she visits, you know, like a Greek diner, you know, a Mexican restaurant, a Japanese restaurant, a soul food restaurant owned by a black couple in town. And so the reason it's so diverse is because, again, like, that's how my world is, right? This is what my the detective and another love interest are mixed, you know, Korean and white. So there's a pretty large showing of ethnicities and cultures in my book. Because, as I was saying, like, it's my world, it's my friend group. Even though it's not based in Chicago, it's just outside Chicago. So I feel like some of that diversity and multicultural aspect would be spilling out over there. I loosely based it on a suburb of Chicago where a particular group of friends live. So to me, it is a very realistic look of what's possible for a Chicagoland or a near Chicago small town.
Well, I was wondering about that because there are certainly in Iowa, which is where I live most of the time. I'm in Austin, Texas right now, but there are people from all those different cultures in in the small towns, although not usually a lot of any one particular culture. And it does seem like there's, you know, maybe some of that in this town too, that there's not a lot of any group.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, it seems like there's a lot, but that's because in an area where you are not the majority, you tend to band together for safety and comfort and things like that. So, you know, you read this book and you're like, oh, there's a lot of Filipinos. It's like, well, there's a good handful. It's just that they all kind of hang out together because the restaurant is a central hub, you know.
Right.
And
right.
The same goes for everyone else. They exist. And that's what I wanted to focus on.
Yes. And in small town Iowa, at least, every single one of those cultures has someone who owns a restaurant. It seems like, you know, we have in the little town I'm in, we have several Thai restaurant owners. We have Indian, we have Mexican American, we don't have any Filipino restaurants. I don't think I've ever actually eaten at a Filipino restaurant, but the way you describe the food, it sounds delicious.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, I think it's very typical of, you know, of immigrant communities where you miss that connection to home. And there's part of my book, the grandmother character is a real stickler for what she considers like the traditional way to prepare the food. And that was my way of kind of doing a nod where for a lot of immigrant families, a plate of food is not just a plate of food. It's the last like tangible connection they have to their home. You know, that taste brings them back to their childhood and things that they know. And so I feel like that's probably a lot of reasons where in small town areas, like if there is an ethnic minority there, they are very likely gonna have some restaurants because that's what kind of brings the community together, which is why I say like the Tita Rosie's Kitchen is kind of the heart of the Filipino community in the Shady Palms town.
Right, of course. So I'm looking at your webpage, Mia, and I see that you, in addition to being a mentor for Pitch Wars, which we talked about earlier, that you offer book coaching outside of that as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, I lost my full-time job at the beginning of the pandemic, and you know, I already had the contract, but as many writers, especially beginning writers like me, will tell you, that's not enough to live on. You know, it's not quit your job money. So I needed something that I had the general skills for and that I could do working from home because, you know, who knew how long this would last? I say a year plus later. But I didn't know what it was until last year when someone who had applied to be a mentee in Pitch Wars, like we turned them down, but they had made like our top five. So the way my mentor team works, me and Kelly, if we request your full manuscript and we like it enough, we will still send you feedback, even though we didn't choose you to be the mentee. So this particular person made it pretty high. We went with someone else, but she liked the feedback. She resonated with the feedback so much. She asked if she could hire one or both of us as her book coach to kind of help her implement the revisions, because that's what a book coach does. That's what makes them different than just a developmental editor. A developmental editor will, like, read your pages and give you an edit letter and feedback, and then they're hands off after that, whereas a book coach will be there creating a revision plan for you, action steps, deadlines, feedback as you're moving forward. And that is something I knew how to do thanks to all my time in Pitch Wars. And so when she said that, I was just like, oh my goodness, is this like a thing that I can do, to supplement my income? And I found that yes. So I enrolled in a certification course. Like, you don't have to be, like, there's nothing that makes you get certification, but if writers are going to trust me with their stories and their money, because it's not cheap, I wanted to make sure that I had invested in it as well. So I went through this course, and I got my certification, and I'm really enjoying it. It's really nice working with writers and helping them make their stories the best versions they possibly can.
Now, are you mostly doing mysteries, or do you do other types of books too?
I I can do other. So I say, I on my site, I'm very clear. Like, I specialize in crime fiction. I am open to other things, but I will only take on what I know I can help. So, you know, there will be people who are like, I'm writing a cozy mystery. You are publishing a cozy mystery. This is perfect. But if I read their pages, and not because they're bad, but just because I don't have a vision for it. If I look at it, I'm just like, I know they need help, but I don't know how to guide them. Then I won't take them on because it's not fair to them. So I have an intake process where they fill out a form, they attach sample pages, and then we also have a free consultation to see if we fit well, because I'm not the coach for everybody. You know, my style, the insight I have to give, it's not for everyone. So there are mysteries that I've turned down because I didn't think I was the right person for them. There are non-mysteries that I would take on just because I'm like, I see what you want to do. I see the potential here. I'm excited about what this could be. You know, let's work together. So it really depends. But my expertise and the most bang for your buck would be in crime fiction.
I noticed that on your website, you mentioned that you're not the best person for overly dark or graphic material, or for writers who are too in love with their work to accept feedback. And that's a big one, isn't it? the world now of self-publishing kind of allows anyone to become a published author for fairly minimal cost. But when I have talked to writers who wanted to self-publish because they didn't want anyone changing their book at all, I'm probably going to steer away from that, from reading it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like, there's a good thing about having a sense of pride in what you've created, but there's also such thing as being too precious with your work. We could all stand to take in, you know, constructive feedback about our work. Because, you know, I tell the clients, like, look, this is still your story, right? So I offer suggestions. I ask questions to help them dig deep, but I can't force them to make these changes if they truly don't want to. There are some where maybe I'll push back on because I think, you know, I know this is kind of a tough change for you, but I really think this is a change you need to make. But if they stand their ground, then unfortunately, you know, that's all I can do. But I think they're just getting in their own way sometimes. I mean, like, I, you know, have my work looked at by other book coaches. I have beta readers and critique partners. I obviously have my editors, and they only have made my writing better and stronger, because as a writer, you're in your head so much, you know, however long, months, possibly even years, when you're working on something, and those outside eyes help you fill in the holes that are there because you're too close to the work. So,
you know, I was just going to ask you that, whether you are using critique groups or anything like that. And of course, you answered it without me having to ask.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mia P. Manansala, and she is the author of Arsenic and Adobe. Now, is poison kind of your favorite murder weapon?
I think it can be really fun. So again, you know, when you're thinking of a food-based mystery, which, again, it's a surprisingly large subgenre, you know, poison is the first thing that comes to mind. If you're going to – I knew this person was going to be a food critic. And, you know, like, if he just turns up with, like, I don't know, a gunshot wound later, like, that's kind of, like, strange, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, like, not that there will never be in the book, but, like, for this first one that establishes this world that revolves around this restaurant as a central hub, there are very few – you know, methods that I could use that would make sense for this. Right. Cause it's not just about a cool, cool in quotation marks, you know, this is about literature, please don't put me on any lists, FBI listeners, you know, like cool ways to die. It's also about what best serves the story. And so here, yeah, Poison just felt right. It felt like the way I had to go.
Now, one of the other kind of underlying themes of the book has to do with the opiate crisis. Is this mm-hmm. something that you have personal experience with, or you know, that you wanted to bring out in this book? I mean, I'm not saying that you're you're a drug addict. I don't mean that.
But. No. Yeah, I understand, because like a lot of people, some people did express surprise that in a cozy, I still tried to touch on some tough topics like that. You know, because you know, cozies are known for being light and entertaining and fun, despite involving crime. And it's strange because when I first started writing, I didn't intend to include it. But as I started delving into certain characters' backstories, and I really thought about real issues that affect small towns, you know, I mean, like I said, like I work at a library, and part of our training is how to deliver Narcan in case a patron has an opioid overdose, you know, in the library. It's a very real thing. It's prevalent enough that it's part of our training. Luckily, I don't have any personal, removed. You know, like there are people in my life who I know who have been touched by this, shall we say, and touched enough that I'm just like, wow, I can't believe that. You know, it's just so common that people will just like kind of offhandedly mention it, or like, oh yeah, you know, again, like the Narcan, it's just like you do it like this, and it's so nonchalant in some ways that it's almost scary. And so it just felt right for me to touch on it. And hopefully I did an okay job, because again, you know, I did some research. I tried to be respectful in some of the ways that I talked about it. I understand it could be maybe triggering for some people because, as I said, it's so prevalent. I'm pretty sure, you know, everyone knows someone who knows someone, at the very least, who has been touched by that kind of tragedy. So,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the other kind of serious topic that underlies this is the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. And maybe sometimes the discrimination that can be faced mm-hmm. in a small town. But you handle that fairly lightly too. But it's there.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to make any comments about that?
Sure. So when it comes to literature facing people of color or people from other underrepresented or, shall we say, marginalized communities, a lot of times, particularly mainstream, it's the stories tend to be centered on that identity, and not just that identity, but the struggle, right? The trauma, the pain, the difficulty. I wanted a story that had a character who was Filipino-American, but it's not about her being Filipino-American. It's just who she is. It's just part of her character. So it colors her perspective. It shapes the way she moves through the world and how the world views her. But that's not all who she is, right? And so that's what I set out to write. But it would also not be genuine or truthful for me to not touch on the fact that, you know, in her role, like, she just is, but the way the world views her might not be so kind in some ways, especially during a murder investigation. You know, the way the police in the small town and some of the small town citizens see her and her family and some of the other suspects who also own, you know, ethnic eateries, shall we say. So there's that line between me wanting to write a character who is just trying to live her life and happens to be Filipino American, but also being true to, like, this is sadly what would happen and how people would view certain characters in this world.
Well,
and
I gotta admit,
like, I walked that line.
I think you did. I gotta admit, though, I was surprised that she was, that Lila wasn't more distressed by being accused of murder. It's like mm-hmm. she still had this trust that it was all going to work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and...
I mean, for that, like, the sense of hope, I think, in The Lightness, that was me trying to meet the genre expectations. Because because we live in a world where, sadly, a lot of us don't necessarily get to be so hopeful that everything will work out in the end and that justice prevails and they'll get the right person. I wanted a book where that happened. You know, it's maybe escapist in some ways, but I don't consider that a bad thing. I think we need that, especially now, considering, you know, how tough things are and the way the world has been lately. You know, that sense of hope of knowing that things will work out in the end, that it was also a choice that I made.
And it makes it fun to read, and it certainly is mm-hmm. a delicious book. So we're out of time, Mia, and I just want to thank you for being with us today. And we always close with a quote. Usually my Caroline comes up with the quote, but since she's not here, I had to do it myself. And this is an Irish proverb: laughter is brightest where food is best.
Oh, I like that.
So thanks so much for being with us, and I look forward to the second in Tita Rosie's Kitchen Mystery Series coming out next February.
So. All right. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this talk.
Bye-bye, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye.